Welcome to our program, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages. We've been spending a lot of time in the past few weeks on the quest for the historical Jesus, as opposed to the Christ of faith. And our last session, which was, I thought, extraordinarily good explanation from Ron Eldred, our guest and our resident scholar, teaches at John Paul II Catholic High, history, Bible, and apologetics. We're going to continue the Jesus seminar today about how they determine what color of bead they put in to vote, red or pink or gray or black. Black meaning Jesus didn't say this at all, and he didn't do this at all, according to their understanding, consensus voting, and it's just things that have crept in. Ron, if we can come back, the very interesting discussion about the Jesus seminar, which is so popular in media today, television, radio, books, and magazines. How does the seminar again determine what Jesus did say or didn't say according to their understandings?
Yes, in other words, how do they decide whether something should be a saying or a deed should be colored red or pink or black or gray? Similar to many other scholars of the historical Jesus movement, the Jesus Seminar treats the Gospels as fallible historical documents that contain both authentic and inauthentic material. So what they're looking for, of course, is criteria of authenticity. In other words, how did you decide whether or not something should be red or pink or black or gray? And this is a fairly complex topic, so I won't go into it here, but because it would take two or three sessions to do that. But I'll just mention that the seminar's criteria for authenticity are four different criteria. One is dissimilarity, another is coherence, another is multiple attestation, and another is embarrassment. And as I said, that would take two or three, maybe more sessions of that to give examples of that. And I don't think it's absolutely essential that we do that. But nonetheless, the members of the seminar do rely heavily on these and other criteria. Some have as many as seven or eight criteria to determine authenticity in their quest to discover the real Jesus or the historical Jesus.
Okay, and didn't the seminar publish its own version of the Gospels a few years ago?
Yes, they did. In fact, I mentioned it in the last session. In fact, it's published several books over the years, including new translations of the New Testament and the Apocrypha to use as textual sources. They're very heavily with trying to include several of the Apocrypha as canonical. In other words, books that the church has
from the Old Testament.
From the Old Testament. Okay. Books that the church, of course, has declared as not being
Seven books in the Old Testament plus parts of Esther and Daniel.
And they're also talking about others. They're including some of what the Catholics call Apocrypha, not what just the Protestants call Apocrypha.
Oh.
I'm talking about the Gospel of Peter, or the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, you know, or the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Truth, or the Epistle of this, or the Acts of that. These are all mostly Gnostic writings, which we talked about quite a bit in some of our earlier sessions. But nonetheless, so far they published, at least to my knowledge, they published three books, Bible-type books. One is called The Five Gospels. That came out in 1993, and the five Gospels, the fifth one, of course, is the Gospel of Thomas. The other four are Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the canonical Gospels. But they've canonized Thomas, the seminar has. The Acts of Jesus, 1998, and the Gospel of Jesus in 1999. And it might have published additional reports since then. In fact, I suspect they probably have, but I haven't been able to keep up with some of their latest developments. But nonetheless, the seminar translated the Gospels into modern American English, producing a so-called scholar's version, SV. They shortened it SV, of the Bible, better known as the Five Gospels. subtitled The Search for the Authentic Words of Jesus. It's a paraphrase or a dynamic equivalence edition. Remember, we talked about these different types of translation theories in our series on understanding the Bible. But nonetheless, it uses current colloquialisms and contemporary phrasing. And as one scholar has said of the translation, quote, "The style is very colloquial and sometimes crude. In the preface, they explain that they have shunned pious terms, preferring instead the average American working vocabulary," end of quote. It's also peppered with inclusive language, meaning by that, of course, it doesn't like to use he or him, you know, it likes to use some neutral term. It doesn't like to refer to God, you know, as Father and stuff like that. The purpose of this translation was, quote, "to let the reader hear the message as a first century listener might have, as a first century listener might have," end of quote. That's from the preface, I think, of the book, if I recall right. To give you an example, they translated "woe to you" as "damn you," mm-hmm. To make it sound more like something mm-hmm. someone would actually say today. Mm-hmm. The authors of the five Gospels maintain that they have tried to preserve each author's distinct voice instead of being like other translations that have attempted to unify the language of the Gospels. Well, the seminar emphasizes the scholar's version. They say that it's free, I'll quote here from the preface again, it's free of any ecclesiastical and religious control, unlike other major translations in English. Since SV, they always call it SV, the Scholar's Version, is not bound by the dictates of church councils, its contents and organization vary from traditional Bibles, end of quote. In addition to the four canonical Gospels, the five Gospels, the name of the book, contains, as I said, the non-canonical Gospel of Thomas, which was discovered in 1945 at Nag Hammadi, I believe it was, in Egypt, and is treated equally with the canonical Gospels, even more than equally, I might say. Believing that the Gospel of Mark was written first, they have placed it first in the book. In other words, they don't have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They have Mark, and then Matthew and Luke, I think, and then John, and then Thomas. The seminar ignores what church councils or documents have to say about Jesus in their recreation of the historical Jesus. And accordingly, the seminar maintains that, quote, "the Christ of creed and dogma, who have been firmly in place in the Middle Ages, can no longer command the assent of those who have seen the heavens through Galileo's telescope. The old deities and demons were swept from the skies by that remarkable glass. The church appears to smother the historical Jesus by superimposing this heavenly figure on him in the creed. Jesus is displaced by the Christ as the so-called Apostles' Creed makes evident," end of quote. In other words, they're saying that the creeds basically are basically fabrications, later fabrications.
Okay, that's a nice poetic statement, but it obviously isn't true. Yeah.
One scholar has commented, quote, "this volume is a product of the ultra-liberal Jesus Seminar, which has received so much undeserved publicity in recent years. Their purpose in creating this version was to promote their skeptical views concerning the authenticity of sayings attributed to Jesus Christ in the four Gospels and in the so-called Gospel of Thomas, an ancient Gnostic document which they believe preserves some sayings of Jesus. The preface informs us that 82% of the words ascribed to Jesus in the Gospels were not actually spoken by him at all."
So those would be in black in the scholar's version.
Or in gray.
Oh, black or gray, because gray is probably...
Probably didn't, yes. Okay,
and black...
Doesn't sound like him, in other words.
Definitely not yeah. black. Okay, well, it's an easy system to remember.
Yes.
Can you give us an example of the seminar's translation?
Yes, the Lord's Prayer is a good example, which one scholar has said that they have been, quote, "unusually generous with the red and pink ink." of course, meaning that Jesus actually did say these words, but not the way they translated it necessarily. And here's their translation. Our Father in the heavens, your name be revered. Impose your imperial rule. Exact your will on earth as you have in heaven. Provide us with the bread we need for today. Forgive our debts to the extent that we have forgiven those in debt to us. Please don't subject us to the test after test, but rescue us from the evil one. End of quote.
Okay, now that's actually not so much different, except when they talk impose your imperial rule, they meant bring about a utopia or a paradise here on earth because there isn't anything hereafter.
Yeah, this is not as crude as some of the ones that we'll be getting into here in the next few minutes.
All right.
Another example is Matthew 23:13. The Revised Standard Version, Catholic edition, or translation says, quote, But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither enter yourselves nor allow those who would enter to go in. Now, on the other hand, the Scholar's Version says, quote, You scholars and Pharisees, you imposters, damn you. You slam the door of heaven's domain in people's faces. You yourself don't enter, and you block the way of those trying to enter, end of quote. In other words, they think they're putting it into kind of contemporary, colloquial English is what
sure.
they think they're doing.
Well, I have to say that's pretty contemporary.
That's pretty contemporary.
And colloquial.
Yes. Okay. But does that really reflect actually what Jesus said and what he meant? I would suspect not. The RSV in Matthew 15:16 states that, But Peter said to him, Explain the parable to us. And he said, Are you also still without understanding? The SV states, Are you still as dim-witted as the rest? End of quote. That's, of course, their particular translation of that.
These are good examples.
The RSV states in Matthew 22:12-13.
Now, the RSV is the Revised Standard Version, both Catholic and Protestant.
Yeah, they're basically the same except for the footnotes.
Okay.
And the introduction, preface, things like that. And he said to him in the parable of the wedding garment, quote, Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Now, on the other hand, the SV says instead, quote, The king came to see the guest for himself and noticed that this man was not properly attired. And he says to him, Look, pal, how'd you get in here without dressing for the occasion? That's getting pretty colloquial.
Well, that's certainly down to earth.
Yes. Another example is Luke 14:11, which says in the RSV, quote, For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. End of quote. Robert Funk claims, he's one of the leaders of the movement, claims that the SV translation, which goes, quote, Those who promote themselves will be demoted, and those who demote themselves will be promoted. He says this strikes a closer note to the modern era. But quite frankly, I think it sounds, he says that the RSV sounds quaint, to addition to being sexist. And actually, I think that this is, and most of the other SV translations sound rather clumsy and crude to myself. I could find many examples. One scholar has said of the SV translation, quote, The editors falsely assert, along with other recent translators, who have catered to the debased taste of our generation, that the Greek New Testament itself was written in a style that corresponds to what we know as street language, end of quote. He goes on to say, quote, Although the New Testament is not written in the refined style of the Greek tragedians and uses the simpler Greek of its time, it is not written in an informal and colloquial style, end quote. The Bible, of course, used during the time of Jesus was written in Koine Greek, which simply means it was the Greek of the, common Greek. It was not the classical Greek that, that the tragedians, Aristophanes and Euripides and all these people had written in. It was Homer, maybe. It was more of a common, what the Latin, in Latin we would call vulgar.
Now, the Vulgate?
Yeah, Vulgate. Now, of course, today, the word vulgar has taken on a different meaning in our own day, but they didn't mean, of course.
It meant common language.
It didn't mean crude language, of course, when we talk about the people
very
speaking
vulgar.
The vulgar or the Vulgate type of common Latin.
Well, I like this next thought you got, Ron, because I think it gives credit where credit's due. Is there any merit to what Funk says about the... Now, wasn't Funk the founder of the movement?
Yes, he was one of the founders, along with Crossan.
Okay, and says about the Bible being attuned to the modern temper.
Well, one critic of the Jesus Seminar has said that, quote, the style of the scholar's version is very much in tune with the modern temper. And we sense that it is especially designed to discourage all feelings of reverence for the text. The Jesus presented in this book is not our Lord Jesus Christ, end of quote. He goes on to say, though, that the SV has one redeeming virtue, in that the editors have been so honest concerning their unbelief and about their desire to aggressively promote their unbelief among the common people who are still ignorant of the assured results of critical scholarship, end of quote. As I stated elsewhere, the members of the seminar, at least its leadership, have a social and political agenda that is facilitated by tearing down the Gospels. And this is an old technique, as we pointed out when we looked at a whole host of scholars, used by enemies of the church or enemies of Christianity, going back to at least Spinoza, through Hume and Schleiermacher and Strauss and Renan and Loisy and Tyrell and Bultmann and the like. And we've looked at all of these and many others in this series. All these men tried to destroy the Gospels so that they could substitute them with their own brand of religion or secular philosophy.
Okay, I want to go back to that one translation about the Our Father, which, do you agree with that? It seems to me to be pretty valid in modern English about lead us not, we say, lead us not into temptation. And what did the SV or the Scholar's Version say?
Our Father in the heavens, your name be revered, impose your imperial rule, enact your will on earth as you have in heaven. Provide us with the bread we need for today. Forgive our debts to the extent that we have forgiven those in debt to us, and please don't subject us to test after test that rescue us from the evil one.
Okay, now I have to say, I think that would be helpful for modern Americans. Don't subject us to test after test, because lead us not into temptation has always been such a stumbling block, because it's old English, and it doesn't come up with, I think, and that seemed to be helpful there. I just want to give a little credit where credit is due, even though, obviously, they're so different from what the church teaches about the true historical Jesus. Well, what are we learning? Is there anything that appears in the Jesus Seminar that is new in what they're saying? Or from what you discussed before in these past sessions, Ron, it seems like they're saying, and some things have been already said over and over again, that Jesus really wasn't God, and Jesus was a social reformer, and he didn't teach about an afterlife, and he wasn't divine, etc.
Especially during the last 300 years, anyway, and that's certainly true. Though claiming to be on the cutting edge of critical biblical scholarship, the seminar's findings are not. They're not new. We've already seen how Hermann Samuel Ramirez was one of the first scholars of the quest for the historical Jesus. He maintained that the New Testament view of Jesus was not historical, but rather a fabrication by his disciples who desired to see the kingdom fulfilled despite the crucifixion of Jesus. Then we see how David Friedrich Strauss in the 19th century followed Ramirez by applying the Hegelian dialectic to rediscover or to recover the authentic Jesus of history by contrasting the traditional supernaturalistic interpretation of the Gospels with the more rationalistic interpretations then popular among liberal biblical scholars. And then recall that his synthesis was the mythological approach. Then we discuss how Rudolf Bultmann, we spent about four sessions on Bultmann, in the first half of the 20th century thought that the quest for the historical Jesus was illegitimate. He argued that the gospel only established the bare fact of Jesus' existence and his death by crucifixion. In other words, Bultmann's Bible wouldn't have had very much red in it either. It mostly would have been black.
Okay.
The words. And he maintained that the Jesus of history is concealed under layers of charisma. In other words, under layers of preaching by later proclamations about Jesus as the risen Christ. And we cannot go back to the Jesus of history, but only to the Christ of the early church's faith, according to people like Bultmann. So he would say the whole search for the historical Jesus was sort of futile. He offered in, once he tore the gospel down, he offered a Heideggerian existentialism in place of the earlier interpretations, and we looked at that. And Strauss and Bultmann both had considerable influence on the thinking of various members of the seminar. There is at least one major difference between Bultmann and the members of the seminar, though, and he was highly skeptical that the real historical Jesus could be found in the Gospels, whereas the seminar believes that at least some of the content of the Gospels is historically reliable. That is, one scholar says regarding this matter, quote, "When all is said and done, what remains is a severely mutilated portrait of Jesus, who little resembles the Christ presented in the Gospels. For the seminar seeks only the authentic historical Jesus. Since the majority of the participants reject out of hand a divine Jesus who worked miracles, who spoke of a future judgment in apocalyptic terms, or who was raised from the dead, anything in the Gospels that refers to these had to be a fabrication of persons with an agenda," end of quote. For example, he says that the Gospels record the miracles of Jesus, which obviously could not have occurred, such scholars argue. Therefore, the Gospels cannot be trusted to be completely historically accurate. We therefore must sift through the Gospels and glean only that which is compatible with reason. That is, a reason that lacks faith. The seminar starts with philosophical presuppositions that determine what counts as historical evidence, presuppositions fundamentally at odds with the message of the Gospels, end of quote.
Okay. Since, as you mentioned earlier, Ron, that it's a small group, perhaps 70 scholars out of a, or what, four, how many was it?
More than 200.
Out of
7,000.
Out of 7,000, yeah. 200 out of 7,000. Why should, as Catholics, we be concerned about the Jesus Seminar anyway?
Well, Professor John McCormick, whom we have quoted several times here in the last few sessions, asked this very same question. And he says, "For after all, they are but a small group of scholars who gather twice yearly in Sonoma Valley, California, to sip wine and vote on what they decide Jesus really said and did. So why should we worry about it, you know?" And he answers by saying, quote, "Because if these scholars succeed, Christianity would be completely disfigured," end of quote. Then he goes on to cite the following facts. Fewer than 20% of the words of Jesus as contained in the Bible are deemed authentic, that is, by the seminar. Of the Lord's Prayer, only the words "Our Father" are close to what Jesus said. The Gospel of John does not contain a single saying that could be traced back to the historical Jesus. In other words, if you look at the scholar's Bible and you come to the Gospel of John, it's solid black. They just don't believe there's anything in John that's authentic. They think John made it all up.
Wow.
He was the eagle who soared. He's the one, you know, who
imagined
and manufactured all kinds of theological things and what have you. Finally, the Jesus that emerges from this seminar was not the Son of God. He was neither the Messiah nor considered himself to be. He was not born of a virgin, never performed miracles, and did not rise from the dead. Although only 30 to 40 scholars attend the sessions twice each year, the media call on them for their latest findings, especially at Christmas or Easter time. I've seen several of these men on various programs on the History Channel or PBS or the National Geographic Channel or some of those other, the Discovery Channel or something of that sort on during Easter time or Christmas time or other times. Mm-hmm. A lot of times these same men show up, including especially Crossan, mm-hmm. Father John Dominic, well, not Father anymore. I don't know, dignify him with that anymore. But the sessions are held around the country and heavily publicized in the local areas where the sessions take place. And to achieve maximum publicity, the public is welcome to these meetings. You know, something which is unheard of course, in most scholarly meetings, you know, where they hold their conventions or their seminars or whatever they're holding. The mass media present the members as great authorities of the Bible, while in fact they have been strongly criticized by scholars such as Father Raymond Brown, who himself is a pretty liberal biblical scholar, as we'll see later on when we spend three or four sessions on him. Of course, the more traditionally minded scripture scholars, such as Luke Timothy Johnson, Father John McCarthy, have been severely critical of the seminar.
Okay, can you tell us more about the seminar's publicity? They seem to be quite adept in getting publicity.
Luke Timothy Johnson describes the seminar's publicity in some detail in his book, The Real Jesus. He has written extensively in this book and elsewhere of the seminar's public promotion of their ideas in the press and television, public meetings, press releases, and the like. Another critic has said of the seminar, although the publicity hounds of the Jesus Seminar have apparently fooled many television and newspaper reporters into thinking that they represent the great majority of biblical scholars, in fact, this is not the case at all, as may be seen in the literature listed below. This reviewer, who was studying at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary when the five Gospels appeared, remembers the decisive comments made by several liberal professors in that school concerning the work of the Jesus Seminar, which they characterized as a fringe element. I mean, these are liberal scholars that even characterize it as a fringe element. What they found most objectionable was the implicit anti-Judaism involved in the seminar's approach in order to represent Jesus as some kind of Gnostic sage, congenial to the neo-Gnostic or the New Age movement of our day. The seminar denies the authenticity of every word which reflects the Palestinian Judaism in which Jesus lived and ministered. And to close this session today, one scholar has said that, quote, those who attend these conferences often leave with their faith deeply shaken, end of quote. That certainly is a good reason for Catholics to be concerned about the Jesus Seminar. And I read that now there is a missionary outreach program underway which takes the Jesus Seminar to various cities in this country and even abroad. And I understand that they are planning to conduct seminars on the Paul Seminar, the Canon Seminar, the Acts Seminar, and the like. And they probably have already done that. I just haven't had a chance to keep up with it.
Kind of scary to me, Ron. Our time again has run out, unfortunately. Thanks for your good presentation. To our audience, may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.